Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Heute mit Katja Weber. Herzlich willkommen bei uns. Wir wollen heute auf Zeitreise mit euch gehen, durch 600 Jahre deutscher Geschichte.
History in Germany is about the future. Gutenberg, the first German that changes the world. Bauhaus, the brothers Grimm. The one artist everybody knows is of course Dürer, eine deutsche Eiche. The idea that you can have a political unit without unity inside is an extraordinary and I think almost entirely German creation.
Wir können glücklich sein zu wissen, dass diese Zukunft restlos uns gehört.
The gate with the inscription, jedem das seine, the noble and the brutal. What is the German history?
Was ist die deutsche Geschichte? Fragt Neil MacGregor heute und er versucht auch eine Antwort zu geben. MacGregor ist ein Zauberer. Einer, der Gegenstände zum Reden bringen kann. Durch genaue Betrachtung, durch sein Interesse und sein enormes Wissen. Sein Geld verdient er aber nicht als Magier, sondern als Direktor am British Museum in London. Ihm verdanken wir den Bestseller »Die Geschichte der Welt in 100 Objekten«. Für diesen Band, wie für die damit einhergehende BBC-Serie, hat er 100 Objekte aus seinem riesigen Museum ausgewählt und anhand dieser Gegenstände nichts weniger als die Geschichte der Menschheit nacherzählt. Ende 2014 wurde im British Museum dann die Ausstellung »Germany – Memories of a Nation« gezeigt. 600 Jahre deutscher Geschichte erzählen MacGregor und sein Kuratorenteam wiederum anhand konkreter Gegenstände. Das Tolle, dieser Blick von außen auf unser Land, auf unsere Geschichte, ermöglicht uns selbst Neues, anderes wahrzunehmen. MacGregor hat Deutsch und Französisch studiert und sein Interesse an deutscher Geschichte und deutscher Kultur wird ihn ab Herbst 2015 nach Deutschland führen. Dann übernimmt er zusammen mit einem Kunsthistoriker und einem Archäologen die Gründungsintendanz des Humboldt-Forums. Das dürfte spannend werden. Denn das Humboldt-Forum ist umstritten. Für diese Rekonstruktion des Stadtschlosses musste in der Mitte Berlins der Palast der Republik weichen. Und nun wächst dort ein Fake-Hohenzollern-Schloss aus Beton aus dem Boden. Dort sollen künftig die außereuropäischen Sammlungen gezeigt werden, wobei immer wieder die unbequeme Frage gestellt wird, ob diese Objekte aus aller Welt, beispielsweise während des Deutschen Kaiserreiches, denn überhaupt zu Recht nach Deutschland gelangt sind. Ich bin wirklich gespannt, wie MacGregor und seine Kollegen diese Fragen beantworten werden. Dass wir interessante Antworten erwarten dürfen, zeigt hoffentlich heute schon MacGregors Vortrag German History for an English Speaking Public, den er am 12. November 2014 an der Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin gehalten hat. Wie der Titel schon sagt, er hält diesen Vortrag auf Englisch, aber in einem britischen Englisch, das die meisten von uns sicherlich aus der Schule kennen. Will sagen, es fällt leicht, ihm zu folgen. Und das, obwohl wir die Objekte, über die er spricht, gar nicht vor Augen haben. Aber egal, MacGregor ist der Geschichtslehrer, den ich mir gewünscht hätte. Einer, der Vergangenes als Erzähler lebendig machen kann. Einer, der ausgehend von konkreten Dingen historische Ideen und Konzepte beleuchtet. Dazu brauchen wir noch nicht einmal die Abbildungen zu sehen, es reicht ihm einfach zuzuhören. Damit der Vortrag in unsere Sendung passt, musste ich ihn ein bisschen kürzen. Eingangs hat er erklärt, dass die Denkmäler europäischer Nationen üblicherweise nur zurückschauen, die triumphale Vergangenheit konservieren, gewonnene Kriege und Schlachten, beispielsweise in Form von Triumphbögen. An dieser Stelle setzen wir ein und ich wünsche euch viel Spaß mit Neil MacGregor und seinem Vortrag German History for an English Speaking Public.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
The German story is of course a different one. The other side of the Siegestor in München is, as you know, very different. Destroyed, damaged by bombs in the Second World War. No attempt made to restore it to its former state at all. Instead, left with the wounds of destruction and with the inscription, dem Sieg geweiht, vom Krieg zerstört, zum Frieden mahnend. I think this is one of the huge differences between our two countries. In Britain, monuments and memories look only back. In Germany, they also look forward. History in Germany is about the future in a way that it is absolutely not in Britain or in France. And I think you can see that linguistically in the fact that the only word that we have is monument, same in France. Normally translated, we're told, by Denkmal. We have no word for Mahnmal at all. It's an entirely German notion. And it is a very eloquent statement, I think, of the difference our two countries take to history. When we address then the question of the history of Germany after 1989, what we were trying to do was really explain Germany now and Germany for the future. Most people in Britain know only two periods of German history, the terrible 12 years, 33 to 45, and perhaps the 4 years of 1914-1918. Very little before 1914, and virtually nothing since 1945. That seemed to us the key task. And as you understand a person by knowing about their history, by their memories, as memories are about identity, and to understand how the world looks to somebody else, you need to be able to think about what their memories are. It seemed to us that some of the best ways of doing this was to think about the memories that all these new Germans brought in 1989 to the new state that was going to be made. Because what, for the British public, is perhaps hard to grasp was the extent to which you couldn't talk about a history for one history for the people of East and West Germany. The placards may proudly have said, "Wir sind ein Volk," but it's ein Volk with many histories, and above all, in East and West, with two very different and very opposed histories. We decided, therefore, that what we would try to do was not to talk about the separate history of East Germany or West Germany, but to talk about shared memories, memories that we could credibly believe might be common to everybody in this new country being forged in 1989. Because what is interesting to a British public is that, of course, that map of Germany that you see on the right in the placard was a state that had never existed as a state until then. This is an idea of Germany yet to be made. And to that idea, what were the shared inheritances, the shared ideas that were brought to explain both how people see their traditions, their past, and therefore their role and their future. It's obviously a very difficult, dangerous thing for any outsider to do or to attempt to do. So we put together a team in the museum of four people, two curators, myself and another curator, two British curators, and two German curators. We have a great many German curators in the British Museum. So our young curator of Chinese paintings and another young curator from our Mesopotamian department, both of whom are German, joined us. And we had an Anglo-German team talking about what might seem important to a German audience and what would be understandable to a British public. And together we began thinking what themes, how we would address it. What were the memories that everybody brought? Obviously, we had to decide where to start, and we were all frightened of the Middle Ages. Only a very brave person embarks on the Hohenstaufen to a British public. So we thought we would start instead with Gutenberg, the first German that changes the world, I think one can safely say, completely changes the world. But also, we decided that one of the things we would try to do to guide a public through a world they don't know was to try to focus as much as possible on some familiar points. I mean, if people don't know German history, what are the German names, moments, objects that they know? Gutenberg, everybody knows. The Bible from the British Library, the first printed Bible, you all know better than I. The determinate moment in European culture when knowledge stops being the privilege of the few and information becomes available to everybody. And we wanted to explain in the radio series and the exhibition why this could have happened only in South Germany, only in that extraordinary culture of river connections, commercial markets, small states, a large literate population with good communication. Why Gutenberg could happen only in Germany. The next name everybody knows, of course, is Luther. Luther, who changes Britain completely, both Scotland and England, as a result of the Reformation. Luther, the Bible, which both creates the Protestant world across Europe and transforms Europe, but also which divides Germany. And the point that we wanted to make very much in the radio series gives a language in which all Germans can speak. Very different from our King James Bible. In both cases, the Bible is a central literary document. But the Bible in English of 1607 is the English of a court, the court of Shakespeare, the court of James I, which is then imposed on the people. This Bible, this German, is invented by one man and is adopted by a people. A totally different way of addressing the question, and in a dialectal, rich country like Germany, a point we wanted to make clear. The one artist everybody knows is, of course, Dürer. And the one object everybody knows is the rhinoceros. A good way to show that Dürer is the first European artist, that just as Gutenberg changes the world by printing words, Dürer changes Europe by using prints as high works of art. And the rhinoceros as the first symbol of the Weltoffenheit of the German Renaissance. These objects are fairly straightforward, and we go on. What we wanted to show was Germany's unique inheritance of technical invention, whether it's Gutenberg printing, Dürer printing, or the invention of porcelain in Meissen. And of course, that immediately the ambition of the making. That most countries in Europe, I think, if they had found the secret of porcelain, would have made delicate little saucers and tiny little cups, just like the Chinese, not the Germans. They immediately make a rhinoceros out of porcelain. This is a very special country. And this astonishing, absurd, wonderful, miraculous object has been lent to us, like so much else, by our colleagues in Germany, of course, from Dresden, and is at the moment the favorite animal of the English. Porcelain, everybody knows, Dresden porcelain is what is always known in England as Dresden porcelain. And, of course, the author everybody knows, the first one, is Goethe. And astoundingly, the Städel lent us the Tischbein portrait. And around this, as come to later, we could build a different kind of narrative. The next name everybody knows is Bauhaus. The extent to which we all see the world through the eyes of Bauhaus was another focus we could build on. Always trying to find names that were familiar, islands of knowledge, of confidence, on which we could construct memories. I hope you agree these are memories pretty well every German would share and claim as German. And then, of course, in the forecourt of the museum at the moment, we have the inevitable VW. There's a whole section of the exhibition called Vorsprung durch Technik. And this is, of course, for everybody, the symbol of Germany after 1945. These were all fairly straightforward. The big question was, how did we talk about the Third Reich? What do we show of the Third Reich? We decided that in the exhibition, we had to have an image of Hitler. What image was the difficulty? And ultimately, we chose from our own collections this children's game, a cutout game, where you can cut out the figure of the Führer and the soldiers. And we came to the conclusion this was the most powerful possible way of showing what a tyranny really does when it enters the everyday and becomes a part of the fabric of everybody's life, even at home. Much more powerful, we thought, than an image of a rally in Nuremberg or whatever, with the public Führer speaking. The idea of people remaking the image in their own house with their children struck us as the way to do this. And, of course, to make the point that whenever we're talking about memories and memories shared by all Germans, the filter, the memory through which everything is seen, is of course not just the Third Reich, but the Holocaust and the other murders. So that was the shape we decided had to be there, and building from those things. But we decided to focus on those aspects of German history which are most different from ours. For that, of course, the biggest difficulty and the biggest difference for an island people is, of course, I mean, Deutschland, wo liegt es, as Schiller and Goethe wrote in the Xenien. And also for one country that has been England, heavily centralized since before the year 1000, Scotland also for 500 years, and then together for 300. The idea of this country in fragments is very difficult. But even more for an island people is the idea that if this is the Germany of 1788, this, the Germany from 1871 to 1919, this, the Germany from 1919 to 1945, and this, the Germany from 1945 to 1989. This is bewildering for a people who have always had their frontiers. And the difference in a historical memory, a national imagining, without fixed frontiers and with so many internal divisions, is an astonishing one. We wanted to explore some of that, but also to make the point that it means there can be no single German history. It is simply not possible. Every one of these, of course, has its own history. What is the German history? It is, I think, if we're going to talk about it only credibly in terms of memories. It's also, of course, connected to British history, since for 300 years, the British, 300 years ago, the Elector of Hanover, as you know, became King of Great Britain. And the most popular German king in Britain throughout the whole of the 18th century would, of course, not have been any one of our own German kings, whom we didn't really like very much. The real hero was Frederick the Great. This is a cup made by the Worcester porcelain factory. There are thousands of cups, saucers, plates commemorating Frederick the Great and the Seven Years' War, the great ally against, of course, the hated French. And together we had seen off the French, as we would again in 1815. And the King of Prussia is not just all over the porcelain of England in the middle of the 18th century, but in 1914 there are several hundred pubs across Britain called the King of Prussia. They all had to change their name very quickly. He's a hero, of course, in Berlin. He's a hero in London. He's not, of course, a hero in Dresden. The destruction of Dresden by the Prussian troops in the Bellotto painting makes it quite clear why you can't talk about a German history. Frederick the Great is not a national hero in the sense that other countries' kings may be. We have to talk in a different way. It's this totally different notion of how a country, a society, fits together that we thought was the hardest thing for a British public to imagine. Britain and France, with their unitary histories, confronted with Germany's uniquely rich, diverse history. So the first thing you see in the exhibition is a map. When George I arrives in 1714, there is one currency for the whole of Britain. The Germany he leaves has 223 currencies. And every currency is, of course, separate. Here he is, King of Great Britain. And on the other side of the coin, rather interestingly, here he is as Elector of Hanover and Prince of the Holy Roman Empire. And it's worth remembering that from 1714 until 1806, the King of Britain sits in the Imperial Parliament in Regensburg as Elector of Hanover. This idea of all these different states, every currency in that map, every single currency is, of course, a state with its own legal system, its own army, its own history, very different from its neighbours. And all of it, of course, somehow under the authority of the Holy Roman Empire. To understand the empire, as you know, is particularly difficult. And we thought the simplest way to try it is through coins again. The coinage makes it quite clear. Here at the top is the emperor and his thaler with the Emperor Leopold. Below him you have, as you'd expect, the electors. This is the elector of Mainz, the Archbishop of Mainz, so the senior person after to the emperor. Then the elector of Cologne with a view of the city on the other side, making the point that these electors are also princes of cities. And of course, would you like to guess which has the grandest, the richest, the most show-off coin in the whole of the Holy Roman Empire around 1700? It is, of course, the free and Hanseatic city of Hamburg, which has the biggest golden coin of anybody, showing Hamburg with Yahweh in the heavens, showing that it's particularly under the protection of God. After that, the secular princes, the dukes, there's the Duke of Sachsen-Weimar. But the coins also show you how all this works. Here you have the Duke of Sachsen-Gotha-Altenburg on one side, but on the other side you have his seven sons. And each one of those seven sons is going to inherit a state which will become separate. So you'll have seven more states when he dies. And then they'll marry back together again, and you'll wind up with fewer. So this endless shifting of the Holy Roman Empire is actually quite clear once you look at the coins, which sometimes show the city as tourist prospectus, sometimes a kind of family photograph album, as you have here. Tiny states, the prior, the abbot of St. Albans on the Rhineland, has only 300 or 400 subjects, but he has his own coinage. And the great and extraordinary phenomenon that there is only one place in Europe where women reign uninterruptedly from the Middle Ages to 1806 and produce their own coinage. And that is, of course, the abbesses of the Holy Roman Empire. Quedlinburg, for instance, it's the only state ruled uninterruptedly by women with their own coinage anywhere. This is a wonderfully rich, wonderfully complicated narrative. And it's a narrative which, of course, we were brought up to think of as a weakness, but which has now, in the last 30 years, certainly in Britain, been reinterpreted as something quite else. Because every one of these states is part of a greater whole. Every one of these states has roughly the same laws, weights, measures. The coins are all of the same weight, even though there are different names on them. And everything happens through the diet, through the parliament, by discussion, by consensus, by slow deliberation, or it doesn't happen at all. In modern Europe, Britain and France have no habit at all of how to negotiate internal power. They've had centralized monarchies, centralized states for so long. Germany has had 1,000 years of practice of dealing with different kinds of political units, which may explain something about what's happening at the moment in our continent. But there's another great advantage of all this. It means that you cannot have one unitary will imposed on the German-speaking lands. And so when the Reformation comes, it wouldn't be possible for the Luther Bible to be published in Britain, in either Scotland or England or in France. The crown would destroy it, and they would burn the people printing it. In Germany, the printers simply move across the frontier. There's another state that's willing to help. The Reformation could not have happened without this wonderful creative fragmentation of the freedom of the fragmented Holy Roman Empire. And that means that uniquely in Europe, when George I comes to England, he has to be an Anglican in England. And when he goes to Scotland, he has to be a Calvinist. And he's both, rather cleverly, because each state must have one religion. Only in the Holy Roman Empire can you have Luther, this wonderful Bible translated with his autograph in it, but you can also, of course, have the great Catholic tradition surviving, this wonderful monstrance from Augsburg, and also you have, under the direct protection of the emperor, the Jews. There is no other state in Europe where officially all three are under the protection of the head of state. And this is something that has become, I think, of greater interest as we go forward. All technically supported by the emperor. and all under the protection of the idea of the Holy Roman Emperor. The idea that you can have a political unit without unity inside is an extraordinary and, I think, almost entirely German creation. And it can't be an accident that almost all the German-speaking lands of Europe, whether it's Switzerland, Germany, or Austria, or indeed the Netherlands, if we count them as German-speaking, are confederal and have always been. This idea of the empire gave us the chance to speak about Germany, I think, in a way that might be hard for non-Germans. And we wanted very much to remind the British public that the German-speaking world was far greater from 1200 to 1930 than it is today. It's something that British people know very little about. It allows us in the exhibition to present a section on German cultural centres which are no longer German. It allows us to talk about Kafka in the context of Prague. Prague as the capital of the Emperor Rudolf, as the centre of the German-speaking world at the end of the 16th century, as a great German-speaking culture, the first German university, until the 20th century. It allows us also to talk about lands which were German until 1919 or until 1945. And so we decided that we would begin the radio programmes as we begin the exhibition outside current Germany, talking about Strasbourg. Strasbourg as a great German cultural city. Impossible to write a history of German culture without Strasbourg. The Münster, of course, which is one of the great achievements of German Gothic. But we have also in the British Museum a remarkable object. As you all know, in the Münster is the great astronomical clock by Habrecht, one of the wonders of the world, a perfect example of German precision engineering of the late 16th century. Habrecht made the clock for the cathedral. Everybody admired the facade, Goethe, of course, particularly, but everybody then went inside to look at the astronomical clock. But he made a portable version of it, and it's in the British Museum. It stands about this high, and it is Habrecht's portable version of the Strasbourg Münster clock. And it is a triumph of engineering. It shows you not only the hour of the day, but the days of the week, the phases of the moon, the turning of the zodiac. It tells you about the Roman and the Greek and the Persian Empire. And right at the top, you have, first of all, at the top of this, of the circles, you have the days of the week, you have the four ages of man, all passing by, and then on the hour, out comes the figure of death. Strikes the bell, then there's a long pause, and then the figure of Christ appears. So every hour, you are reminded of your death and judgment. Another pause, and then it plays Luther's music for the Vater Unser. This is a great German Protestant mechanical achievement in a great German Protestant city of the 1580s. And it stays that, of course, until the French aggression of the 1680s and the Louis XIV aggressions against Germany. This wonderful print from the British Museum shows the emperor about to attack the French cock strutting over the Rhineland with its claw on Strasbourg, showing, hoping that the French will be repelled. It is, of course, not what happens. By conquest, by naked aggression, Strasbourg, although totally German-speaking, totally German, becomes part of France. And it's in the French Strasbourg that Goethe discovers, looking at the Münster, Deutsche Baukunst. And that extraordinary statement about Gothic being the German art form, the German art form, the art form which is superior to anything that the mere Latins in Italy or France can boast. Only a German, he says, could have built this cathedral. This is ours, and the French have nothing to compare with it. It's a wonderful document of early German romantic enthusiasm for a national tradition of art. And, of course, it happens in what is no longer a German city. The history we wanted to show again, we can do easily, by this wonderful print celebrating the return of Strasbourg to Germany in 1870. You can see the soldiers from the different Confederate lands celebrating the Kaiser. On the left, Strasbourg, on the right, Köln, and between them marked Der freie deutsche Rhein, the song that Schumann had written the music for in the 1840s, when Thiers, the French, decided that they might reoccupy the Rhineland and make Cologne French again. And here is the 1870 moment. This is history that is very little taught in Britain. History in Britain starts, if it starts at all, in 1870 with the making the new empire. None of the earlier history. And, of course, the remembering of Strasbourg is one of those great differences across Europe. The French are not at all amused by 1871. And the statue of Strasbourg on the Place de la Concorde is, as you know, draped in black. And the infant Charles de Gaulle is brought in front of this by his parents as they all stand looking at the Alsace and Strasbourg draped in black. It's a city now obviously permanently French and since 45 French-speaking, the city overwhelmingly. But you can't tell a history of German culture without Goethe, without Habrecht, without Strasbourg. And the same is true, of course, even more, I think, at the other end of the story, because again, we started the radio series, the first words we spoke in Königsberg, and the sentence ended in Strasbourg. I think it's much easier for a non-German to do this, but it is an essential part of what Germany has been, and the role of Königsberg, which you all know very well, of course, the founding by the Teutonic Knights in the 1250s, and all that remains of that city being, of course, the cathedral. But it allowed us in the exhibition, in the book, and above all on the radio series, to talk about Königsberg as, of course, the place where the Elector of Brandenburg can crown himself, this wonderful image of him simply taking the crown and doing it himself. No need for any bishops, any archbishops, nobody. Self-crowning. And what then the way Prussia now becomes the determinant name and in many ways the determinant spirit of Brandenburg and indeed of what is going to shape Germany. Königsberg also, of course, the one philosopher we knew we could, the one philosopher that everybody in Britain is comfortable about pronouncing, quite apart from anything else. You have to remember what your public can manage. And everybody who's read any philosophy studies knows something about Kant. We wanted to remind them all, of course, that Kant never sets foot in what is now Germany, spends his entire life in Königsberg, and is never anywhere else. Those two elements of Königsberg, very well known to you, not well known to our public. But the other element we wanted to focus on was, of course, what happens in 1806, when Napoleon enters Berlin after Jena, after Auerstedt, after the complete defeat of the Prussian army and the royal and the humiliating removal of the Quadriga. And we have this wonderful cartoon in the museum of Bonaparte making off with the Quadriga for Paris. The royal family, what they do when they retreat to Königsberg. So to be able to show the iron jewelry of Königin Luise and that extraordinary Roman Republican decision to abandon luxury, give your gold, give your jewels for modest iron. And iron as the symbol of Bescheidenheit, Entschlossenheit, a simple, not noble metal, which is an egalitarian, strong metal that shows a whole people united against the oppressor. And that idea of Prussia in 1806, 1807, after the humiliation of Tilsit, as really the only place where there's serious resistance to Napoleonic tyranny. That moment which, for a British public, is very similar to 1940 for Britain, as the only resistant to a tyrannical, dominant European force. And epitomized And here we came back to the one thing that our public would know, which is, of course, the Iron Cross. But the Iron Cross as a symbol, not just of military valor and braveness in fighting, but an egalitarian symbol, the first German order, honor, to be available not just to noblemen or to commoners, but to everybody, whatever their origin. The great statement of a people together in arms, the union of the liberal intellectuals with the military national in a great campaign to free not just Prussia and Brandenburg, but the whole of Germany. It was 50 years before the British Army moved to a similar honor. The Victoria Cross, also for the first time to be given to officers and men, or to men as well as officers, soldiers of all ranks, copying very deliberately, in the case of the Victoria Cross in the 1850s, the Iron Cross of Prussia. This is a story that people know, of course, the Iron Cross from the other side. To see the values that it represented of that moment of Prussia is a powerful story, and I think a powerful reminder of the role of the Wars of Liberation in the making of any German memory. How did a country respond to total occupation for 20 years, to annexation not just of the West Bank of the Rhine, but ultimately of Bremen and Hamburg into metropolitan France? How does a country redefine itself? And one of the great loans from the Deutsches Historisches Museum is, of course, Napoleon's hat, captured by Blücher. And we all grow up in Britain learning of Wellington's prayer, I wish it were night, or that Blücher would come, or that the Prussians would come. So it's another thing we all understand. And we wanted to make this point about the role of 1806 in images like this wonderful one, print of the 1850s, when the French were again thinking about invading, of the powerful memory 50 years later of 1806 as a rather nervous Germania watches what's going to happen. Königsberg, we felt, was a good place to focus on, particularly because, of course, as you all know, it has now been completely obliterated. Kaliningrad has virtually no trace at all, a wonderful, terrifying Stalinist obliteration of memory, the street plans destroyed, the names changed. And yet, Königsberg is, of course, part of a German memory. When you go to Königsberg today, those of you who have been, you know the only thing, apart from the cathedral, that tells you what was once a great German city is the manhole covers, all of which have Steinfurt on them, and so on. It is impossible to tell a story of Germany without Königsberg, without Kaliningrad. There is no comparable phenomenon for Britain, or for France, or for the United States. These great historical centers lying beyond, removed by the result of war, absolutely removed, a people gone, people of Königsberg removed or killed, and only a memory, but an important memory. Staying with what people knew and talking about the resistance, the Wars of Liberation, we thought the obvious way into this phase is also Friedrich. Friedrich is familiar. What people don't know is the extent to which Friedrich, in paintings like Der Einsame Baum, is using the oak as an emblem of Germany that has survived the winter of French occupation, has been battered, has lost some of its bloom, but is still there, still strong, still resolute. And it's come as a great shock to our British public to discover that the oak is a German tree. We all thought of it as an English tree. We grow up singing about oak and hearts of oak. And the discovery that there's eine deutsche Eiche has been quite a revelation. Friedrich takes you back to the Wars of Liberation, the different ways in which the Wars of Liberation change an understanding of the landscape. What is it we all share? We all share the landscape. Exactly as Constable in England at the same period imagines an England which has been threatened by French invasion and has survived free and beautiful. Friedrich and Constable very close together, and the role of nature in this new Germany that's had to rethink itself without the Holy Roman Empire, a new kind of identity, and of course the Chasseur im Walde, that great link that the Germans have had, we're told, ever since the Teutoburger Wald, that in the forest everything will get sorted out. German virtue will prevail. That allowed us to go to another thing. If we think of these islands of knowledge that an English-speaking public have, as well as Friedrich, the other one is, of course, the Brothers Grimm. We all grow up with Rapunzel, with Snow White, with Hansel and Gretel. Most people don't know that the Grimms were, of course, the great historians of the German language, that the reinvention of a German, or the discovery of German philology, of the identity of a German language, which is separate, which makes a nation, that this is what one of the reasons the Grimms gather these fairy tales, that this is to say, who are we as Germans? We are the stories we tell ourselves. And those stories are gathered together, and they become another way of how a Germany, without a Holy Roman Empire, after the dislocations of Napoleon, defines itself. And they are an area that is familiar in one sense. Again, Hansel and Gretel, Snow White, they go into the woods, just like the Chasseur, just like Hermann, and they emerge somehow, purged, strong, new. We go right the way through. In fact, we call this chapter in the book Snow White Against Napoleon, as a way of the, and I think it's not unreasonable that these stories are a kind of articulation of the German self, a memory of language, of narrative, of moral development. They're all, in a way, a Bildungsroman that shape a nation. And at the same time, as Grimm, as Friedrich, of course, in Bavaria, another Germany is being imagined by the Prince of Bavaria, later Ludwig I, the Walhalla. It opens in 1842. Turner, the poet, the painter, the English painter, goes. He's completely overwhelmed by it. He paints one of his wonderful late paintings of the Walhalla, now in the Tate Gallery, and he writes one of his worst ever poems. He's a terrible poet, and a really dreadful poet. But peace returns. The morning ray beams on the Walhalla, reared to science and the arts, to men renowned of German fatherland. And this idea that you could define what Germany is by bringing together images of the great German speakers of all time is, of course, at the basis of the National Portrait Gallery that we get to again much later, an extraordinary idea that this is what Germany is. Ludwig, in his introduction, says that the idea came to him in that winter of 1806-1807, after the humiliations of Jena and Auerstedt, that he realized he had to rethink Germany and build this temple for the great men. It's here that I think the, if you look at the Walhalla, and of course it's an easy thing to do in the book or in the radio, you see again how memories shape, change, how we all need to keep selecting the past we want. And of course, the Walhalla, when it opens in 1842 in Bavaria, you can imagine the one great German of whom a bust is made, but not present, is Luther. And the first great debate about who enters Walhalla is over Luther. And he doesn't come until the revolutionary threats of 1848, when the king decides that it might be wiser to show a little more tolerance in general, and Luther comes in. Who is in Walhalla? Who is in this notion of Germany defined by the Bavarian authorities is, of course, a fascinating tree. We've got nothing comparable to it, I suppose, besides maybe the poet's corner in Westminster Abbey. Who is there? The first Jew in Walhalla is Einstein, who doesn't arrive till 1990. And then, of course, the question of how the Third Reich, how this memory is incorporated into this house of memory with the image of Sophie Scholl in 2003 And below her, the Schrifttafel im Gedenken an alle, die gegen Unrecht und Terror des Dritten Reichs mutig Widerstand leisteten. She's there, very controversially, as you know, Edith Stein is also there, and equally controversially, the man who loathed Valhalla and wrote satirically against it as a Schädelstätte, of course, Heine, who arrives in 2010, the latest arrival, with a great split, as you can see in the bust, showing that he's rather surprised to be there. We've got nothing like this. And although it's a Bavarian view of German history, it shows the problems of all these memories. Who is in, who decides, and what are you saying if you take Edith Stein but not Hannah Arendt or something of that sort? These decisions are fascinating ones for us to consider. I want to finish very quickly with the two other things that, for us, are remarkable. And the first is, if you like, the Weimar problem. We decided to take Weimar as a focus, for the obvious reasons, of course, that it's the city of Goethe, that Goethe, the first author to be read outside Germany, the first worldwide German success. Werther has a huge success in England, translated quickly into English, and the German and the British buy, again, porcelain with Werther on it. Every bit of the Werther story is on a bit of this coffee set. You can follow him all the way through, putting on his blue coat and yellow waistcoat and eventually shooting himself. And as you know, hundreds of people did. It became the great bestseller, the first great youth bestseller in Britain. It was the beginning of a revolutionary youth. Parents obviously were rather upset at their children shooting themselves in large numbers. But he was read and copied and reread. And Goethe and German became part of cultured life in England. But Goethe is, of course, we wanted to say, much more different from Shakespeare. Goethe is not just a writer. He's, of course, you know all this. Of course, he's a botanist. He's interested in fossils and minerals. He's interested in optics. His wonderful color cards about optics designed to show that Newton was wrong. He was very convinced Newton was wrong. And right at the end of his life, his capacity to be interested in everything is what we wanted to show to our public. That Goethe is not just a writer. He is a man of the Enlightenment, embracing the whole world, translating Hafiz, interested in minerals, and interested in all modern technology. At the end of his life, he has on his desk a little model of Stephenson's rocket, the first English train. And he very unwisely says that he hopes that one day Germany will have a railway system just like England's. Great men are not always right. The role Goethe plays as an emblem of a certain kind of German, I mean, for me, summed up by the fact that in Frankfurt Airport, as you embrace the world and set off, or the world comes to Frankfurt, you have your cup of coffee under the statue derived from the Tischbein. He is an extraordinary, humane, cosmopolitan memory. And, of course, you know all this, but for our public, to be reminded that this, of course, is why the Weimar Republic is proclaimed in Weimar, the choice of a different history for a different future. And the Bauhaus with its wonderful geometric, cosmopolitan, world open, Klee, Kandinsky, all of them coming from all over the world here to work in Weimar, and all of them representing something completely new, but also very conscious of their connections with their own history. The Klee Kandinsky invitations to the Bauhaus exhibition are very consciously derived on the Goethe color cards, which they knew and studied in the same city. This is a revolution founded in tradition. It's the high point, I think, two high points of a cosmopolitan, humane view of the world. And of course, also in Weimar Buchenwald. And so we wanted to put in the exhibition not just the great Tischbein portrait, which the Städel astonishingly has lent to us, and objects from the Goethe House, not just the Bauhaus cradle and designs, but the gate from Buchenwald. The gate with the inscription, Jedem das Seine, an inscription designed by the Bauhaus typographer Franz Ehrlich, who, like so many in the Bauhaus, was a communist, was arrested for treason, imprisoned in Buchenwald, and made to design the inscription on the gate. Unusually, an inscription that faced inwards, so that the prisoners saw it as they were on parade. Not Arbeit macht frei, the brutally cynical Jedem das Seine, translation of that great Roman legal maxim suum cuique, Jedem das Seine, the great idea of Roman law, of justice, to each what is their due, what they are entitled to. The title, of course, of a Bach cantata performed in Weimar. All these traditions come together and die in Buchenwald, in this gate. And yet, Ehrlich astonishingly uses in his, as he's a typographer, he uses a Bauhaus typography, the typography that the Nazis hated. They hated the Bauhaus as being international, left-wing, embracing foreign traditions, and he uses this wonderful, simple, new, modern typescript, typeface. A private act of resistance, perhaps, an assertion of dignity under tyranny, perhaps, a statement that there is another Germany, a different, noble Germany that survives the Third Reich, certainly. And this object, beside the Tischbein portrait and the Bauhaus material, raises clearly for anybody the fundamental question: how do these three elements coexist? The great freedom of not being a German presenting this is that there is no need to attempt an explanation. It can be left as the great question, the great human question, of how in all civilizations the noble and the brutal coexist, and how in Weimar that happens at a level found nowhere else. It's a paradox that one needs to ponder, and I don't think we need to answer. But I want to finish, lastly, in Berlin with the Reichstag, because it's the perfect demonstration, not just of modern Germany, but of how you use your monuments and your past for the future. The way this building, obviously the fruit of 1870, the building for the united Germany of 1870, was put up, then, of course, how the Nazis viewed it, the dislike for it, the Reichstag fire, which everybody knows about, and the pretext of the fire for the rounding up of the communists, the destruction of the Reichstag, which Stalin identified as the symbolic building on which he wanted the red flag to appear on the 1st of May 1945 at such colossal cost. All these are known to a British public. And this building, with its poisoned history of the Bismarck and the Kaiser antipathy to the elected parliament, then to the Nazis' dislike of the Weimar parliament, then the Third Reich, then the Stalinist occupation, this building had to become, of course, the seat of the Bundestag. And what amazes us is the way that was achieved. Not just the choice of a foreign architect, which is already a wonderful statement of openness to the world, but the way these terrible historical memories had to be exorcised. And I don't think it's too fantastical to think of the wrapping of the Reichstag as a kind of secular exorcism. That the Reichstag entered this wrapping contaminated, and it emerged as something new. But in it, the decision to leave the Cyrillic graffiti of the Red Army, the decision to ensure that legislators every day were reminded of what happens when the state fails and the price of that failure, the decision to have above the Reichstag the transparent dome, not just a symbol of transparency, but to allow the inheritors of two tyrannies to exercise their surveillance over their rulers and to put the public above the rulers symbolically. No other country in the world has done this. No other country, I think, would leave in its parliament, in its central public building, memories of its own humiliation, its own failures, and of the need to turn them into the future. That is, I think, what is unique about German memories and German history, that even looking across the worst history that can be imagined of the Holocaust, of the separation and the Brandenburg Gate, it's possible always to think future, to the future, to a different future, shaped always by the memory of that past.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Die Zukunft erwächst aus dem Vergangenen. Und Neil MacGregor, noch amtierender Direktor des British Museum in London und künftig einer von drei Gründungsintendanten am Berliner Humboldt-Forum, meint, die Deutschen wüssten das aufgrund ihrer Geschichte sehr genau und brächten es in ihren repräsentativen Bauten auch zum Ausdruck. Ein großes Kompliment, das hoffentlich auch stimmt. Falls ihr jetzt Lust habt, euch mehr Geschichte, mehr Geschichten erzählen zu lassen, schaut euch gerne online in unserem Hörsaalarchiv um, da werdet ihr mit Sicherheit fündig. Katja Weber wünscht euch noch einen anregenden Abend. Bis bald.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.